The answer, it seems to me, is compounded of many factors. Industrialization and standardization have improved our living standards and culture, but they have also organized us into herds with little control over our destiny, apprehensive of our future as anonymous social security numbers. Our splendid industrial civilization has exacted a heavy price in the comforts of neighborliness and the fulfillment that people once got from working for themselves as part of a community. Politically, new powerful aggressive ideas have emerged and reemerged to challenge the democratic idea which has been in the ascendancy for so long. Our free society has been buffeted by the hammer blows of communism and fascism and their autocratic antecedents for a generation. And we're a little rattled. We're a little rattled because democracy, freedom, unrestricted inquiry mean tolerance, consent, persuasion, diversity. They are the antithesis of the iron conformity, the hero worship ritual, the fanatic obedience of totalitarianism. Our values are rational and peaceful. Totalitarianism, on the other hand, cultivates a passionate, fighting, political religion. When freedom didn't exist, it too was a fighting faith that men would die for. But now that it does exist, it looks a little pale and gentle and lacks the appeal to the militant, irrational sentiments which were once mobilized by conquering religions and now by totalitarianism. But my friends, totalitarianism can't win in the long run. It resolves no anxieties. It multiplies them. It organizes terror. It is without spiritual content or comfort. It provides no basic securities. In the long run, it cannot cure the disease of the anxious age. And this we must, but this I think we must remember about it. Its short-term methods are grimly effective, as we have found out. We can't sit still and wait for the fever to run its course, passively protesting our devotion to democratic ideals while indulging in undemocratic practices. A schizophrenic society which recoils in horror from a godless materialism, but blinded by our own material well-being, loses sight of its spiritual heritage, won't long hold out against the subtle poison of doubt and fear. If Western civilization is to save its body, it must save its soul too. It must resolve the anxieties of mass civilization. It must awake again the emotionalism, the confidence, the defiant faith of a resolute breed of men to whom democracy and freedom meant something positive every day, not just when war has reduced us to the stark issue of self-preservation. It's easy to care mightily then. It's hard now. It's easier to fight for principles than it is to live up to them. But now is the time that a confident, fighting faith in freedom counts if we are to avoid another war and if we are to avoid the greater menace of bloodless surrender to our own anxieties. So I urge you, the sons and daughters of Illinois, to act like the resolute breed from which you are sprung. Don't stand aside, afraid of the great continuous decisions of your time. You are the inheritors of a great tradition, born and nurtured in centuries of pain and effort. You have received here its best gift, an education. Man the defenses of the humane tradition against its avowed enemies, its covert foes, indifference and ignorance, and its frightened friends, who would surrender it to save it. You have the components of good judgment and of wise decision, and many of your decisions will be executed through the instrument of government. Now, one thing I can assure you, if responsible citizens like yourselves don't make that government good government, responsive government, there will always be irresponsibles and worse, ready to usurp the positions and the leadership which should be yours by every consideration of intelligence and of integrity. And remember, if you fail to do the chores of organized society, the power of the state will expand. And as it does, it beckons to the dictator, to the demagogue, to come and organize its vast intricacy. For us? No, for him. For these tasks and these exciting opportunities, use the equipment that God and this great university have given you, and that your own industry each day improves. Use your heart and your head and not your prejudices. You are more than the social animal that Seneca spoke of. It is because we are more than animals that we can blow ourselves off the face of this planet in the next 50 years. It is also because we are more than animals that we can make this world a better place to live than it has ever been before. Now, I can't close without reminding you of the high purpose of the institution from which you are graduating. University is a proud and noble word. Around it cluster all of the values and the traditions which civilized people have for centuries prized most highly. The idea which underlies this university, any university, is greater than its classrooms, its laboratories, its athletic plant, even the particular groups of faculty and students who make up its human element at any one time. Now, what is this idea? It is, it seems to me, simply that the highest condition of man in this mysterious universe is freedom of the spirit. And it is only truth that can set the spirit free. The function of a university, then, is the search for truth and its communication to succeeding generations. Only as that function is performed steadily, conscientiously, and without interference, does a university realize its underlying purpose. Only so does a university keep faith with the great humanist tradition of which it is a part. Only so does it merit the honorable name that it bears. As you depart, then, from this campus that you have known and loved, I bid you to fix your thoughts increasingly upon the inherent ideas and purposes of this great, proud, free university. Don't forget that it's a university as well as your university, and that it has obligations to the whole of mankind, which it can neither ignore nor shirk, and which cannot, consistently with its honorable name and place in the community of scholarship, be sacrificed to passing passions or prejudices. Be alert to its need, but keep always in the forefront of your vision the realization that the greatest single need of any university, as of any seeker after truth, is not money, not expensive libraries and laboratories, but freedom. Freedom to do its work, to pursue its inquiries, to conduct its discussions, to extend the limits of learning. See to it that no one, for whatever reason or in the service of whatever interest, diverts this university from its basic objectives or sets its sights lower than those of any other university in the whole civilized world. As its graduates, as individuals who have made in it an investment of the golden and irretrievable years of youth, you cannot, I suggest, do less to pay your debt and carry away with you some part of the wise serenity, of the timeless courage, the unhurried objectivity, which represents the collective imprint of its founders, its students, and teachers who have gone before. And finally, my young friends, don't be afraid of your world. Don't worry about what might happen. Start thinking now about what you are going to make happen. It's a good time to be alive and awake. It's exciting. It's your time. And you can say with our great American philosopher Emerson, if there is any period one would desire to be born in, is it not the age of revolution, when the old and the new stand side by side and admit of being compared, when the energies of all men are searched by fear and by hope, when the historic glories of the old can be compensated by the rich possibilities of the new? This time, like all times, is a very good one, if we but know what to do with it. Goodbye, good luck, and my thanks for your patience.
When Governor Stevenson had finished his talk, he returned to his chair on the speaker's platform, but he had to stand again to acknowledge the applause of the overflow audience in Huff Gymnasium. President George Stoddard extended his own personal invitation to the graduates to come back anytime they wanted to, and his own personal congratulations upon their completion of their academic career. After his personal greetings had been extended, George Dinsmore Stoddard, president of the university, awarded the degrees as listed in the official program: Doctor of Philosophy degrees, Master's degrees, Professional degrees, and Baccalaureate degrees. After graduates had received their covers from the heads of their various schools and colleges, They remained standing, and as the body sang, Hail to the Orange. Graduating class was then joined by the audience in singing Auld Lang Syne. Mark Hinesley directed the University of Illinois Concert Band. The graduates then filed from Huff Gymnasium to be met outside by their many friends, well-wishers, and parents. And so concluded the commencement exercises of the largest graduating class of the University of Illinois in its 82-year history, a class of 3,767 young men and women.